Ladies and gentlemen, I have some bad news. We are 30 minutes behind schedule. But the good news is it's not 45 minutes like the first day when we had the first break after 45 minutes delay, and then everything was delayed even further. But I think this is permissible given the fact that we will have a celebrated speaker as our keynote speaker of the day, Dr. Elmer Bill Colglazer, Editor-in-Chief of Science and Diplomacy, a journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Bill has been the Chief Science Advisor to President Obama, and in his present role as Editor-in-Chief of Science and Diplomacy, he is the key person nowadays worldwide in giving a platform to this new discipline, how science is used in diplomacy, what is the role of science in diplomacy. And this is especially important in 2019, this year, because this year is the 20th year of science diplomacy, which started practically together with the first World Conference on Science here in Budapest. Bill, the floor is yours.
Well, it is an honor and a great pleasure to be with you this morning, sort of continuing this discussion of science diplomacy over the last 20 years. And you've already had, I think, a wonderful introduction to science diplomacy by the opening statements, again demonstrating the importance and the recognition of what science has to offer for actually helping societies to achieve their most important goals. I'm going to spend a moment talking primarily about the role of science, technology, and innovation as a tool for advancing diplomacy, foreign policy, international relations, actually as a very pragmatic tool. This recognition has become, I think, increasingly recognized first in the science community, of course, but much more so recently in the diplomatic community. And we heard that this morning from the State Secretary, from the Minister from South Africa. I also was going to quote just a couple other things that have come from foreign ministries over the last couple weeks. There was a recent statement from the Swiss foreign minister on science diplomacy as an innovative tool in our international relations. Just a couple quotes. He said, "Science diplomacy is a key instrument for fostering cooperation between states. As part of Switzerland's new vision for its foreign policy," he said, "we want to focus on this new instrument, still little known but very promising science diplomacy. It's an opportunity for Switzerland to showcase the excellence of its scientific base in support of global dialogue." I have a number of friends who have been science counselors in Swiss embassies and consulates. I think they would probably say Switzerland's been practicing it for more than 20 years, but I'm very glad, I'm sure, that the foreign minister recognizes it's important today. There was this recent Madrid declaration on science diplomacy. It was organized by one of the research groups that are funded by the EU, looking at science diplomacy options for the EU, both inside the EU as well as with the rest of the world. It was a meeting that was held in Madrid, and it was partially organized by the foreign ministry of Spain. And this Madrid statement was signed by participants at the meeting. And it presented, I think, a quite eloquent common vision of the role of science diplomacy in the future. Let me mention one other example which illustrates the importance which diplomats are now paying to science diplomacy. There's this network that's been in existence for a couple years called FEMSTAN, Foreign Ministry Science and Technology Advice Network. It was actually created by several people who hold the positions like the science advisor to the foreign minister in countries. Now, people with that title or similar titles, there's more than seven, in fact. The meetings of FEMSTAN actually bring more than 20 countries from foreign ministries to talk about the issues that are common to them, both about building capacity and science, technology, innovation in the foreign ministry, is how they can work together in common objectives. The next meeting of FEMSTAN actually occurs in Vienna next week. So all of these things illustrate that diplomats also are paying increasing attention to science diplomacy. You know, at the end of World War II, when all of a sudden this great threat of nuclear weapons was made visible to the world, it's been 75 years. Actually, what we talked about then over those 75 years was science and international affairs, science and diplomacy, growing importance, particularly how to deal with these terribly destructive weapons. I had several mentors in science who were great, distinguished scientists. They never served in government, but I consider them also to be great science diplomats. Some of them were involved in the Manhattan Project, in fact. But after that, after what happened, they devoted a lot of their time outside of science, having dialogues with scientists in the Track 2 dialogues outside of government, with scientists in the Soviet Union, later also with China, with issues of arms control. How can we actually control these weapons and influence our leaders to actually dampen down the threat of these terribly destructive forces? And when there were windows of opportunity in the diplomatic sphere, which happened in the 1980s and 1990s, these Track 2 discussions actually had significant influence in the arms control treaties that appeared not long after that. Although I was trained and was a practicing physicist, I eventually moved into kind of the world, this interface between science and policy, and I went to a new center that was established at Harvard University in the 1970s by one of my mentors, Paul Doty, biochemist who was involved very much in discussions with Russian scientists. It's called the Center for Science and International Affairs, now called the Belfer Center of Science and International Affairs. But its purpose also was to bring together people who work on foreign policy issues, science and technology, diplomats, to focus on these common issues. So science and international affairs has been with us for a long time, for 75 years. In fact, I turn 75 tomorrow, so I think I've been around for the 75 years of this era. So the question is, you know, why did we drop the "and"? We used to talk about science and international affairs, science and diplomacy. Now we talk about science diplomacy. And I think there is a significance in the change of language. One, I think it's made it a much more popular term, and that in itself is very helpful. My own concept is science diplomacy. Trying to make it a very pragmatic one, primarily how science and technology innovation. When I talk about science, it's not only the physical and biological sciences, the social sciences, the engineering sciences, the medical sciences, applications of science technology and expertise related to that, but I also think in many cases, scholarship in the humanities and in culture is also quite relevant as a source of knowledge trying to deal with these issues. So the way I think about science diplomacy primarily is science technology innovation used as a tool to actually compass objectives in foreign policy and diplomacy, looking at it in this sort of pragmatic sense. Of course, there's the other way around. It's very important to scientists, obviously, a diplomacy that can help advance the scientific enterprise both nationally and worldwide. And I think the diplomats have realized if they don't do a better job trying to facilitate, remove some of the obstacles to international scientific collaboration, they're not going to be as effective in using science as a tool for advancing diplomatic goals and objectives. But who are the practitioners of science diplomacy that use this tool both inside and outside government? At the international level, the national level, also at the subnational level. And I'll just mention some examples because I think the examples are quite powerful. Institutions, individuals, initiatives, mechanisms, which I think have made a difference and had created a number of successes in science diplomacy. Starting off at the international level, obviously UNESCO is a science diplomacy institution. That's what it's been devoted throughout its history. We heard one of the talks in the meeting here from the CTBTO, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization, which of course brings the technologists dealing with monitoring nuclear explosions, trying to help get final approval of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. The CTBTO is also a science diplomacy institution. EASA, the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Vienna, it was actually created by an initiative of the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union to have a a place where scientists from during the middle of the Cold War, scientists could work on systems analysis approaches to deal with some of the major challenges that the world faces. And of course, EASA is still very active. The International Science Council, formerly ECSU, has been around for a long time, focused very much on strengthening science around the world, but also more so in growing over time its role in terms of science diplomacy. I consider the World Science Forum to be a science diplomacy initiative. It's a wonderful over 20 years. It's creating a lasting legacy, and it's grown over time. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a unique partnership with the science community and the policy community, I think has made a difference related to how we deal with climate change. As part of the UN's 2030 agenda, you know, the diplomats recognized wisely, I think, that if the world was going to be able to make progress on achieving the Sustainable Development Goals, they were going to have to do a better job of harnessing the power of science, technology, innovation. They called it strengthening the science policy interface. They didn't know quite how to do it, but they, as part of the 2030 agenda, they created what this new entity with a strange name called a technology facilitation mechanism. Technology could facilitate achieving the 2030 agenda. With several unique aspects to it, probably the most innovative actually was creating what's called an IATT, Interagency Task Team of UN agencies, the World Bank, the World Intellectual Property Organization, where each one has only one representative, over more than 40 now involved, but they create working groups to actually try to make progress practically on, and I'll talk about one of the initiatives briefly, just a little bit later. So the TFM is a science diplomacy initiative. The World Science Academies. Back in the 90s, I was involved in the creation of what was then called the Inter-Academy Panel, the Inter-Academy Council, now called the Inter-Academy Partnership. It's also a science diplomacy network of science academies, both building the capacity of science academies, but also to help them become more important advisors on issues in their own countries. Another network, which was created a couple of years ago, INGSA, the International Network of Government Science Advice, which actually now has regional meetings as well as the big international meeting, where they bring people both from the foreign policy, diplomatic community, and the science community, talk about how we can strengthen the science advisory ecosystem in countries. Yesterday, I heard had a very interesting meeting with representative of the science leadership in Saudi Arabia. The next G20 meeting is going to be in Saudi Arabia next year. There also, over the last couple of years, there have been what they call the S20 meetings, which are meetings of the science community leadership in the G20 countries. And so Saudi Arabia is thinking about what would be the major theme for the S20 meeting next year. But also, I think, quite importantly, to make these S20-type meetings not just one-off events, but also like the World Science Forum, how to create it so it's a cumulative process learning so that the S20 meetings also become another science diplomacy initiative. If you look at the national level, the fact will FEMSTAN, with all these foreign ministries now, they're increasing their capacity to deal with science and technology issues and developing their own strategies for how to use science diplomacy, all these FEMSTAN countries. Scientific academies and professional societies domestically at the U.S. National Academy of Sciences creating a brand new, what they call, roundtable on science diplomacy for the United States, how the United States can be more effective in using science diplomacy as a tool. The AAAS, which is very proud to be one of the partners in producing the World Science Forum. Some of my colleagues, Vaughn Tariqi and others, created the Center for Science Diplomacy a little over 10 years ago in the little online journal, Science and Diplomacy, to try to bring together practitioners to talk about examples that are quite relevant for trying to think about new approaches to deal with problems through science diplomacy. I just came from a meeting in Jordan. I'm on the board for a science diplomacy NGO called CRDF Global. It was actually created at the end of the Cold War, created by the U.S. government, but created as an NGO, and its purpose was to help transition weapons scientists in the states of the former Soviet Union to work in civilian research and development. Now, CRDF Global actually works around the world. In Jordan, they have an office with 30 bright young Jordanians, highly trained, very capable, and they focus on security issues related to nuclear, chemical, and biological technologies and science, not only for Jordan, but also for the MENA region. And of course, Jordan, 2 years ago, Princess Somaya, the Jordan, was the host for the World Science Forum. It's impressive being back there last week, seeing the great progress that's made in building the science and technology capacity there. But also individuals. Frederica Mayor is a wonderful science diplomat. Some of the mentors I talked about who were involved in these Track 2 discussions, they were great science diplomats, even though they were never in government. In the audience today, I see many great science diplomats. I think individuals also were extremely important to carrying this message forward. So what are the five elements, in my view, that make science diplomacy such a powerful tool? One, first of all, every country, when I was a science and technology advisor to the Secretary of State, I met with over 70 countries to talk about issues. The first issue raised by every country, no matter its level of development, was how can we strengthen the capacity in our country, build up our science, technology, and innovation capacity. I think the statement from the State Minister this morning, I see, was really emphasized that. Every country wanted to talk about that. How do we create a vibrant, innovative ecosystem that actually brings benefit to our nation, both for security, both for prosperity, being competitive in this highly competitive, interconnected, globalized world? And as you heard from the statement of the Swiss foreign minister, they see it as actually a great advantage because Switzerland has a very high-level innovative ecosystem and their engagements around the world using that as one of their tools in terms of their diplomacy. The second issue is there's great concern right now over the negative implications and disruptive potential of rapidly advancing technologies. I mean, you all are well aware of all the different technologies from artificial intelligence, big data, synthetic biology, you name it. There's a lot of concern at the diplomatic level that these advances are moving so rapidly. They can be very disruptive to societies. They can be very disruptive to international relations. How can we actually minimize the downside in the negative effects? So that's one of the reasons why foreign ministries are building up their capacity to deal with these kind of issues. The third aspect, which makes, in my view, science and diplomacy such a powerful tool, is the ability of the scientific community to actually communicate, no matter what their ethnic background is, no matter what borders, even when their governments don't get along. And the diplomats have recognized that having that channel of communication through science, actually, when there are no other channels of communication between countries, is still worth maintaining. For more than 15 years, from 2000 to actually just recently, I was involved at the request of the U.S. Department of State for the U.S. side, the National Academy of Sciences. The same thing in Iran with their ministries, encouraged the science communities in the two countries to have a very active engagement, 3 or 4 workshops a year. They were not on the nuclear issues, but they were on environmental issues, their public health issues, earthquake protection. All of that dialogue helped with what actually, when the real negotiations on the nuclear issues started, the fact that there were these early discussions between the science communities were enormously helpful. The fourth element of why science diplomacy is such a powerful tool is, as we all know well, science, technology, innovation are an ever-expanding resource. It's an inexhaustible resource if we do it wisely, and it can bring benefits, as we know. And actually, in some cases, it can create new pathways that leap over the diplomatic obstacles. I think the Montreal Protocol is a great example from that. It was not only the science community pointing out the challenges presented by fluorocarbons as a refrigerant, it's also the technology industry who developed new refrigerants that act so they could actually eliminate the ones that were causing the most serious problems. And last, the fifth element is sort of spreading the values that come from doing science. We certainly heard a lot of that emphasized in this meeting. The talk by Franz Corby the other day emphasized integrity. But it's all the issues of relying on evidence, objectivity, peer review and transparency in publications, valuing excellence. The hope is that by having every country pay more attention to their science community, it'll at least help contribute, do we hope, to a more rational, open, and tolerant societies. So what are some of the examples of science diplomacy successes? I'm just going to mention three, but also primarily to illustrate another issue we have, that you can't forget about the politics. Because in the short run, the politics can overwhelm the science. And these three cases present, I think, some of the challenges. The first, the nuclear arms control. I already mentioned that. The treaties, arms control treaties in the 1980s and the 1990s. Now, you know, the United States and Russia are backing away from a number of those treaties, which the Paris Climate Agreement, facilitated in part by the work of the IPCC, tremendous achievement. Didn't get us all the way we need to be on climate, but it was an important start. And then, of course, the United States is the current government is backed out of that. The Iran nuclear accord, the same thing. The United States backing out. So certainly in the short run, politics can be a more powerful force than science. I'm still an optimist and believe in the long run that that science will win out. It's one of my mentors in science, the famous physicist Richard Feynman, said he was on the Challenger Commission report after the Challenger accident of the space shuttle in the 1980s, and he had an appendix to the report which, if you summed it up in just a short phrase, was, you can't fool Mother Nature, and politicians that disregard the knowledge that comes from science are doing it at their peril. So how do we make progress looking to the next 10 years, including perhaps redressing some of these areas where there have been these significant setbacks and progress has been stalled? Well, again, I'll pick five areas where I think there's great need for science diplomacy being involved, perhaps in some cases new instruments or just using our existing instruments, institutions, and individuals. But also believe there are great opportunities in these five areas. One, of course, is controlling these technologies of modern warfare. It's not only nuclear weapons, but now we have autonomous weapons facilitated by artificial intelligence. We have hypersonic weapons that move so fast that the fear of a first strike could lead to serious miscalculations that result in cataclysmic damage, cyber attacks, and offensive information warfare. So this whole area is something that really the science community needs to devote a lot of their energies to. The second is providing foresight and facilitating dialogue on the implications of these rapid technological advances in all of these areas to societies. We have to give the best advice we can on how to maximize the opportunities and minimize and deal with the threats that are created from these new technologies. This is, as I mentioned, is growing attention at the diplomatic level to the negative consequences of many of our technological developments. But we also see great opportunities if we harness the technology in the right way. The third is maintaining a channel of communication between nations that have estranged relations. In some cases, they're so estranged, you can almost say it's getting back into the equivalent of another Cold War. Just for the U.S. government, I feel our relations with Russia, our relations with China, our relations with Iran, all of those need more effort from the scientific community, making that contact with the scientists in these countries that can help provide perhaps pathways that can lead to progress and restoring better relations. The fourth area is accelerating progress, obviously, on the UN 2030 agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, but especially for the global environmental goals, the SDGs that deal with oceans, biodiversity, and climate. It's not only for the scientific community pointing out the problems and issues, as well as ways that we can actually deal with these great challenges, but also helping countries, essentially, what is their share of the global responsibilities, getting them to commit. It's in their national interest as well as in the global interest to join and make commitments to help us deal with these global environmental challenges. And the last area is science, technology, innovation, capacity building in developing and emerging countries, which I think is also highly important. And I will mention one initiative because I think it is very, very important. It sort of combines the SDGs with this last one on building capacity in science, technology, innovation in emerging countries. I mentioned in this technology facilitation mechanism, I had the honor of co-chairing the advisory group for 2 years for the TFM. Enjoyed working with the real diplomats in the UN and what they're able to accomplish in a rather unique place. In fact, the most interesting meeting when I was doing that was the meeting we had with the ambassadors who negotiated the creation of the TFM. And their basic message was, we don't know how to harness science technology better, but we want you to figure out how to do it. And I think the challenge of those of us who've been involved is the aspirational rhetoric is wonderful, but also to think about how to make it concrete in terms of real action. So most of the action is going to occur at the national level and the subnational level in harnessing science, technology, innovation to deal with all 17 of the SDGs. Well, the initiative I want to mention, which I think may become the most important initiative of the TFM, in fact, it comes out of a working group of this IATT, this Interagency Task Team. It's led by the World Bank and the government of Japan, but it involves UNESCO, UNCTAD, UNIDO, several other countries and UN agencies as well. And that's to develop what are called STI for SDGs roadmaps. So what is that? Well, a roadmap's taken from the technology sector. We used to talk about like in the semiconductor sector where the technologies lay out a long-term goal or vision, and the steps that they think an accomplishment, the research they're going to carry out, the actions they're going to take, but their feedback loops and feedback mechanisms to say what's working, what's not working, what can we change to continue marching along to the goal. And now, countries at the national level, many of them have a national plan looking at whatever national goals are important to them. The science minister often has a science and technology plan looking at how they build the capacity. Sometimes the other ministers don't pay as much attention as they should to the plan of the science and technology minister. And now countries are also, many countries are developing their plans for how do they address the SDGs. Well, the intersection of all these plans is the area that's the focus of the STI, Science, Technology, Innovation, STI for the SDGs roadmaps. And it's helping countries to build not just a top-down effort to build these roadmaps, but to build it by engaging all the key stakeholders in society down to the local level with their science and technology community so they get societal buy-in to these plans. Well, this effort, and there is a guidebook that has now been, it's in draft form, it'll be finalized in December, which will be on the draft is on the UN website now, which is a guidebook for nations that want to actually experiment in developing an STI for SDGs roadmaps. And they're funding five countries as pilot countries who have agreed at the highest level in the government to undertake this effort. Three are in Africa, Ghana, Ethiopia, and Kenya, and two others, India and Serbia. And these five countries are the pilots. They're going to try to develop this over the next year. I'm trying to get more of the science community in these countries injected into this process, but there are roughly 20 other countries that are examining to see how it works and the relevance. Could this be something that actually could stimulate, you know, real action at the national and subnational level in trying to accomplish all the variety of things at this intersection of these three different national plans? For all five of the things I've mentioned, there are two things I would hope the science and technology community remembers and how they can contribute using science diplomacy in these efforts. First of all, more engagement with stakeholders at all levels to understand their needs and aspirations. You know, less talking from the science community, more listening to understand things better and helping to actually use science and technology to address the needs and aspirations of people in society, what they really care about and are trying to accomplish. And the second is for institutions that want to use science diplomacy as a tool to accomplish whatever their objectives and goals are, to think very carefully about their own institutional roadmap. You know, how are they going to learn? How are they going to have the feedback loops as they learn and try to move forward in the future? My very last comment is on the legacy of the UN 2030 agenda, particularly the connection of science, technology, and innovation. My own personal view is the greatest legacy will be creating more knowledge-based societies around the world. I think that is where the great potential is. Every country now has very smart people. When you talk to young people, it makes me even more optimistic about our future, even with all the problems that are occurring around the world today. But if we can make every nation a knowledge-based society, have a very competent science advisory ecosystem, highly trained people engaged around the world, then I think we will all benefit. And I would like to acknowledge that I consider that the World Science Forum has been a very important contributor to this, trying to make all nations of the world knowledge-based societies and also a great science diplomacy instrument. Thank you very much.